Independence Day. It's Independence Day.
Let freedom ring, let the white doves sing, let the whole world know that today is the day of a reckoning, let the weak be strong, let the right be wrong, hold the strong away, let the guilty pay, it's independence.
Infants on Thrones, philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. Hey, remember last year around this time when we released an episode called Independence Day, and it was a collection of listener essays that we were just too lazy to really do the proper way and have the author come on and talk with them about what they had written? Remember that? And remember how they were good and people liked them? And remember how the real Stephen Hawking introduced everything?
Hello, this is the real Stephen Hawking again.
Remember when he said this?
The infants asked me to come back mainly because a few of you listeners asked me to leave. You are tired of hearing my voice. I remind you of your own mortality. And you would rather listen to real, live, healthy voices. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
And remember when he said this?
So today we have some excellent listener essays for you.
And then he went on to say this?
No, it's not a purge. This time it's Independence Day. Because not only are all of these listener essays being liberated from the confines of their electronic prisons, where some have sat for almost 2 years, but they also each tell their own story of independence, in one way or another. And they are awesome. Trust me, I'm really, really smart.
Do you remember that? Because we're going to do it again, but with different essays, of course, and from just 1 year of neglect. Hey!
Sunday, Monday, happy days.
This is probably the closest that Infants on Thrones ever comes to flashback episodes, you know, like in your favorite TV shows where they show clips from previous times. I mean, this isn't really clips from previous episodes. It's listener essays and everything, but... So here you go. A gaggle of listener essays.
It is seriously alarming how many believing members of the LDS Church, as well as those of many other faiths, I'm sure, respond so casually with a "it has never really bothered me" type response to the following question, often proposed by atheists and doubters. If God is real, and He really is our loving Heavenly Father, how can He allow so much pain and suffering in the world today? Now, to be fair, I will admit that before I lost my faith, I had used this same unempathetic response on several occasions to proudly boast of my unwavering belief in God and in His plan of happiness, a plan that permits us the blessings of free agency. I knew it was true. I had no doubt. So there was really no need to address the aforementioned question. I could easily and without guilt allow story after story of genocide, slavery, starvation, disease, and child abductions, abuse, and neglect to bounce off me with about as much impact as a small ripple of water hitting the hull of an aircraft carrier. I didn't need to allow to enter into my mind the images of terror groups ruthlessly gunning down innocent commuters on busy highways in Afghanistan. I didn't need to empathize with the mourning mother of a cancer-stricken child. These horrible aspects of real life didn't faze me because I knew God had a purpose and that all would be made right in the end. The tragedy is that because I never really digested these cruel mechanics of life, they weren't ever real, which means the victims of life were victims in vain. Their sorrow was for nothing because to me, it didn't exist. So now I ask myself this question with new perspective, that of a doubter. If God exists, why would He concern Himself so much with helping me find my car keys while the prayers of a 10-year-old sex slave in Taiwan fall on deaf ears? Now, your run-of-the-mill 18-year-old missionary would probably reply something like this. Well, it's easy, you see. God gives all men free agency to do as they will. That way, he can judge us in the end to see if we were good and deserving of heaven, or if we were bad and deserve to go to hell for eternity. But it isn't until you truly question everything you have ever been taught in Sunday school about God and his character that you're able to look at that answer with anything less than raw enmity. This is how you go through life without ever actually experiencing it. This is, of course, my own perspective and might not necessarily be shared by other current or former Mormons. But either directly or indirectly, I believe that I was mostly taught that this life is simply a means to an end. It is a probationary state, and as long as we hold our breath long enough, we can look forward to someday gasping the delicious fresh air of exaltation, with all its awesome eternal world-making and everything. This is why I get so upset today when I see social media posts from believing friends and family fighting to preserve traditional marriage. It's why I get headaches at church when I hear testimonies about people who are cured by a priesthood blessing. It's why I refuse to teach my children that God's church is led by men who have taught in the past and in many ways continue to teach today that we were born in this day and age with all of our white privilege because of our obedience in the pre-existence. You can talk yourself into doing and believing just about anything when you know that what happens here in this life is nothing compared to what's going to happen in the next. So I repeat, it is alarming how frequently believers will so casually dismiss their own participation in life because of their certainty in an afterlife and in a God that is just and fair. And if he is just and fair, then it is just and fair that I'm a middle-class white male with almost no characteristics that would warrant any sort of discrimination, disadvantage, or handicap, while other men my age and other parts of the world are brainwashed into strapping a bomb to their chest and walking into an elementary school. This is the aspect of Mormonism that was the final straw on the camel's back. I could deal with all the scandalous history and the temple weirdness. I could try to be a New Order Mormon and participate in Mormonism without actually believing in it. I did for years. But it was the realization that Mormonism was making me numb to reality that did me over. It is elitism at its best, or maybe its worst. My somewhat recent rejection of Mormonism and in religion in general, has in so many ways advanced my spiritual well-being orders of magnitude greater than had I stayed. I have a lust for life and an empathy for others that I never experienced throughout my tenure as a Mormon. Even my most peaceful and magical experiences in the celestial room in the temple don't compare to the peace and happiness I feel while having real, honest, existential-type conversations with my wonderful wife. It sounds very angry and anti-ex-Mormon to say that Mormonism is captivity, but in so many regards, I feel an unfamiliar freedom in my departure. For the first time ever, I feel the bitterness of life's cruelty. But with this awakeness is also ever present a recommitted desire to experience life with my kids and my wife in a more meaningful way. After all, Christ taught that he came that we could have life and have it more abundantly. Or to quote possibly an equally mythic character in Peter Pan, to live would be an awfully big adventure.
Come on, Nana!
When there's a smile in your heart, there's no better time to start.
The former things, a never Mormon finds Mormon podcasts. I am not a former Mormon. I am a former many things. A former Pentecostal, a former evangelical, a former worship band leader, a former confirmed member of the Anglican Church, a former believer in the gift of physical healing through the complete gospel, a former denier of my sexuality as a gay person, a former submissive woman who honestly believed that my gender somehow made me less than the man sitting next to me in church. I'm also a former member of the LGBT Christian movement, a former disabled Christian, a former theologian and biblical scholar turned critical theorist of religion. I'm a former emotional wreck, a former believer in my almost inevitable damnation, a former lurker in the shadows of the Christian church, never quite good enough to come all the way into the light. The wheelchair ramp only goes up to the edge of the altar. I don't belong in the pulpit. I'm a former gullible chump. I was deceived. I was told lies about God and about his judgment, about the plan of salvation and my need to respond to it, about evolution and science, about sexuality, about gender. I grew up in a church where women were expected to be subservient to men, and I thought feminist was a dirty word for many years. I was prevented from experiencing love and marriage. I was told my desires for those of the same sex were deviant and unholy. And I believed all of this. And I am many current things. I'm a person with Asperger's, now finally free from the constant terror that I could never be good enough to avoid hell, with my religious scrupulosity a symptom of a condition that I didn't know I had. I can no longer be found praying the sinner's prayer at 2 a.m. for the 20th time that week, in case Jesus hadn't heard me because I don't try hard enough. I'm a person with a physical disability, now finally free from the empty, aching disappointment of never having been physically healed. I can no longer be found crying in bed, begging God to heal me from my pain, to just tell me what I need to do to be worthy of the gift of healing of the full gospel. I no longer ask why Jesus doesn't want me to be healed, or why my faith isn't strong enough. Today, I study the experiences of disabled people who encounter Christianity. I share the stories of the people who come to church and can't get through the door, who aren't well enough to attend services and are never reached out to by their local church, or who work hard to fit in with their religious communities but will never be quite good enough because they haven't experienced physical healing. Amplifying their stories is both an academic and an activist project for me. It's also a long path to healing. A healing of the kind that is actually possible and desirable for me, not the kind of healing that isn't possible and that I don't need. My body is perfectly human the way it is. My heart may be a bit more of an issue, though. Today, I know that pain and disability are human experiences, and my activism is focused on helping to create a more socially just, accessible world for me and the other 20% of the UK population that is disabled. Today, I still struggle deeply with the feeling that I'm not good enough. Asperger's can be a difficult condition to live with in our cruel, normalcy-obsessed world. There's a lot of confirmation from the, quote, normal world that I will never be fully accepted. The solution for me is not to work more obsessively to fit in, but to educate others and work towards a better society where we all accept the full range of our humanity and that of others. Today, I am in a same-sex civil partnership with a wonderful person, an atheist who fully supports my weird spiritual seeking and who is non-binary gendered. I'm finally free from the insidious myths about sex, sexuality and gender that limited me for so long. Today, I would probably call myself a neo-pagan, and that's the spiritual community I identify with and find my inspiration in. Sociology, science and academic inquiry come first in my life, though. Approach everything with scepticism. Think, think, think. Very few people understand these experiences. When I stumbled upon ex-Mormon podcasts about 3 years ago, I discovered an unexpected kinship that I rarely encounter elsewhere on the internet or in modern media. You are bold enough to speak about the former things. You know that the past shapes the present and the future, and that if we don't keep talking about these things, others will be deceived, misled, brought low by philosophies that they too can be free from. You are people who understand what it means to be former. You are people who understand what it means to be free. Thank you for that.
I only watch G and PG rated movies.
Oh yeah.
My parents raised 8 children in Mormon Mesa, Arizona. I went to Mountain View High School, where every day I walked across the street to a large seminary building just off campus. This is where I joined hundreds of Mormon students in the indoctrination of Mormondom. So it shouldn't be surprising that at one point, I had a circle of friends who prided themselves on abstaining from not just rated R movies, but PG-13 movies. I've never even seen a rated PG-13 movie. It was somehow a self-righteous badge of honor. The New Yorker me of today would have responded, "Okay, want a fucking cookie?" I guess I can't fault my friends for their self-righteous attitudes when this type of standard was being shoved down their throats by leaders. I can see it now. The Mormon ad that shows a picture of an ice cream sundae with a cockroach in the middle of it. It reads, "It's great. Except for...
except for the bad parts."
At home, my parents weren't any more strict than other parents in my community, but on Sundays, they went above and beyond. We were only allowed to watch church-produced movies on Sundays. We rotated between the cult classics. The Mailbox, Pioneers in Petticoats, Uncle Ben, On Our Way Home, and we loved Johnny Lingo.
Mahana, you ugly.
The best part was we could watch Saturday's Warrior on Sunday, but we had to fast forward the two scenes where Jimmy's friends dance salaciously in front of the camera, tempting him into zero population and the summer of fair weather. Those were the bad parts.
This is the summer of fair weather, and I know a place where we can get it together.
Titanic came out in 1997 when my dad was a member of the bishopric. I was only 10 at the time, but my 13-year-old sister begged my dad to take her to see it. He took her, but like any good Mormon father, walked her out during the nude scene where Rose poses for Jack in all her feminine glory. That Sunday, our bishop held a youth fireside where my dad was in attendance. The bishop didn't call out my dad publicly, but he talked the entire evening about the evils of PG-13 movies and how even after taking out the bad parts, it's not okay to see them at all, ever. By the time I was 13, the no PG-13 rule was in full effect. I didn't care too much about movies, but like any kid, I was curious and wanted to see what was all the fuss. I was old enough that my parents were dropping me off to see movies with friends. One of these times, I went with my friend Jackie, whose parents had left the church when she was 2. Her parents were cool with her seeing any movie she wanted, but to my parents, we lied and said we were going to see The Emperor's New Groove. But instead, like the naughty little girls we were, we went to Mel Gibson's movie. What Women Want. Yes. I recognize that this was such a waste of rebellion, especially since Gladiator came out that same year. It was a pretty stupid movie, so even though I wasn't a fan of keeping arbitrary rules, I didn't waste my time rebelling super hard on this one. Fast forward and I'm ready to go to college. I moved to Boston and found myself the most righteous Mormon boyfriend and got accepted into the Boston Conservatory of Music for musical theater. During orientation week, the school put on a show that students performed in a small black box theater. It was a play by Carol Churchill called Cloud Nine. I was going to school for musical theater, so I assumed it would be safe to invite my priesthood-holding, much older, member of the Stake High Council, very faithful TBM boyfriend to come with me. We found our seats in the small, intimate theater, and the show began. It's a rainy, stormy night in British colonial Africa during the Victorian era. There's a carpet on the floor and a woman sitting in a chair upstage. In dimmed lights, a man crawls under the carpet up to where the woman is sitting, lifts up her skirt, and eats her out. In the second scene, the same man has an argument with his wife who is being played by an effeminate man. In the next scene, a young boy, played by a woman, is molested by his uncle. We made it through the first act, and as you can imagine, my boyfriend was running to the exit. He hated it. We couldn't even talk about what we had seen. Looking back, I will admit it was shocking. But there was something about those scenes that really intrigued me. This wasn't Mel Gibson's What Women Want. This was a show that was exploring sexuality and oppression and gender, and I wanted to know more. I wish I could give a real analysis of what I actually saw that night and what it meant, but I didn't get a chance to process it, nor did I have the knowledge or experience to understand it. I just knew I didn't have a problem with it like my boyfriend did. But shouldn't I, as a Mormon, have a problem with this? This would be rated R, right? And that's bad, right? There were so many bad parts. It was the perfect introduction to my education at the conservatory, where nothing was off limits. Acting classes sometimes included nudity, and always included shits, goddams, motherfuckers, and fucks. Lots of fucks. Randy would love acting class where profanities are necessary for some characters. And while nobody was having sex on stage or in class, there were plenty of scenes where women faked orgasm or a man appeared to be fucking another man. Bestiality wasn't even off limits. Do you know there's a play called The Goat or Who is Sylvia? It's about a man who's in love with his goat and having sex with her. And then there's the Vibrator play, a play about the first electric vibrator and the liberation it brought sexually unfulfilled women during the Industrial Revolution. My freshman year, I played a woman who was confronting a man who had raped her in high school. I was grateful for the words given to me by the playwright, where I got to damn him to a miserable death. Death by a steel rod being shoved repeatedly up his inside so that when his sphincter collapsed, his last bowel movement would be saturated with blood from the draining backwash of his rotted fucking pathetic guts. Who wouldn't want to say that to their sex offender? Thank God for colorful language. As I dove into the curriculum, the initial shock from that night watching Cloud Nine wore off quickly. It wasn't all drugs and sex and adultery. It was just messy and raw and real. Now, if I were to channel Glenn channeling true believing Mormons, I'd say, well, no wonder you're questioning your membership in the one true Church of God. You've lost the spirit. You're desensitized. Well, Holly, channeling Glenn, channeling TBMs, that can't be right. I was my most faithful when I was in school. I was in the state primary presidency, even an ordinance worker in the temple. No, none of this uncensored art led me to question my faith in a God, and faith that the Mormon Church was the best way to stay close to that God. Quite the opposite. Being exposed to messiness and imperfection gave me more empathy for others, myself, and even the church. I didn't need to be perfect. The church didn't need to be perfect. A couple years after school, after having moved to New York and meeting and marrying my super dope and rad husband, we found out through the news that the church would be holding disciplinary councils for Kate Kelly and John DeLynn. I didn't know who these people were. I wasn't involved in any of the fringe Mormon communities up to this point, and besides my husband, most of my close friends weren't even members. But after seeing their membership was a public point of interest, I was intrigued. So far, I knew Kate Kelly was the leader of Ordained Women, a movement I hadn't heard of until this point, and as for John DeLynn, it was unclear to me why he was under the church's microscope. All I knew was he supported gay marriage, and if that was means for excommunication, kick me out. So I turned to the Mormon Stories podcast to try and figure him out. I already knew that Joseph Smith had been sealed to multiple wives. I'd even heard that he'd been sealed to other men's wives, so I thought I'd listen to Grant Palmer explain more of the details of Joseph Smith's story. Some of it I'd heard, some of it was news to me. Still, I'm not easily shocked. I knew Joseph Smith was a fallible man, so I thought I could probably get past this. I kept listening. I listened to Grant Palmer, Margaret Toscano, Brent Metcalf, and so many others, and became outraged that some of these people were disciplined for their intellectual honesty. The church's censorship and then abuse to members who don't toe the line is what really bothers me more than the dirty facts themselves. I know humanity can be ugly and dirty, but why the whitewashing and the bleaching? Do they not trust their members to make intelligent decisions based on the facts? Or do they feel pressure to prove their beginnings were divine with a crystal clear history? Is the appearance of perfection really worth the abuse? Today, I'm still active, currently serving in the Relief Society presidency of my ward. I'm totally conflicted about my membership in a church that pushes perfection to the extreme. I still like some of the teachings and stories from the Book of Mormon, even though it's fiction. And I still want to live like the New Testament Jesus taught, even if he's not the literal Son of God. But if I hold the church to its own standard of perfection, what do I do now that I describe Mormonism to my non-member friends by saying, "It's great, except for the bad parts"?
Bowling at every Mormon taboo to see how many I can knock over in one round. I once had a coffee-infused beer after flirting with the lesbian bartender. She gave it to me on the house as her welcome to adulthood when my writing buddies ratted me out as a recovering Mormon and the wife of a drag queen. Chris and I met when I was 17. I snuck into Institute because I was lonely. My ward had exactly 3 girls and young women who were my age, and I didn't have much in common with them. I wasn't interested in getting married, but I also didn't mind the idea of going on dates, so I took a don't ask, don't tell policy in regard to my age and went. Chris and I were engaged 6 months after I showed up and married a year later. I had a wedding instead of attending my high school graduation. We've been married for 6 years now. The day before Thanksgiving 2013, we left the church. I had been a feminist, liberal Mormon ever since our daughter was born and was heartbroken at the church's response to ordained women. In sharing my lament, I remember asking, "Are we even Mormon anymore?" And Chris took that moment to share with me. He had been an atheist for over a year, waiting for the right moment to tell me. When he begged me not to leave him, I realized I couldn't go back, that my attempt to add diversity to the church would only place my marriage under constant scrutiny. I already knew feminist Mormons who were encouraged by their wards to leave their fallen spouses, and I would rather leave my God than Chris.
Tithing had been a struggle for us as a family on one teacher's income, and it was often the subject of fights within our marriage. So, in solidarity, the Sunday after Thanksgiving, I took our tithing money and we went to the zoo. We bought every snack we wanted, every souvenir. Our daughter got a pink flamingo, and we even bought tickets to go through the butterfly exhibit. Though I was still grieving, holding my family's hands and walking through the butterfly pavilion was the first time I felt at peace in a very long time. This began our process of bowling at Mormon taboos. The first time Chris dressed in drag, it was for me. We attended a drag comedy show as a fundraiser for an LGBTQ scholarship at our local university, and I bid in the silent auction on a drag makeover. When I won, he told me it was his anniversary present to me. Cheetah Daniels Kennedy brought boxes of makeup to our house and began. I sipped on wine like a third wheel, watching the transformation. I think it may be something akin to what fathers feel when their wives are giving birth, helpless, a spectator in something grand. I did help Chris put on pantyhose, a corset, and the black flapper dress, but Cheetah did the birthing. She painted his face, beauty mark, lush lips. Occasionally, she would turn Chris's head to me, showing me a sweetly stunning face, a gentle beauty with fiery eyes. "She's sweet and soft, but if she were mean, she'd be a real bitch," I said. "Oh, honey, yes," Cheetah said as she picked up the red wig. We sat him in front of the mirror and placed the hairpiece, and there she was, Alexa Taste, wrapping her lips around a postmodern jukebox song, twirling the curls in her hair.
She stood up and danced and kept dancing and singing and looking at herself in every reflection.
I became violently jealous. She was so carefree and relaxed in her own skin. I had never been so freely a woman. I had to fight for every moment of beauty, and I hated him for being so easily beautiful, so better at being a woman than me. I wanted immediately to sink my fingernails into her skin and make her cry, make her feel like I had all through high school and every moment since in which I just was not good enough. I also hated myself. What horrible thoughts to have. My husband became incredibly vulnerable for me, and I was being ungrateful, resentful even. And at the same time, I also wanted to take her to bed and have my way with her. I wish this was the moment I realized that I am queer. Instead, I froze, because I didn't know what to do. I knew that even though I wanted to hurt Alexa, I would damage Chris and my marriage if I did. So I just sat in my emotions and waited. Alexa turned to me. "It's so wonderful to finally feel beautiful," she said. And I fell in love with her. What grace she gave me in that moment when I didn't know how to escape myself. She understood what it is to look in the mirror hoping to find something worth celebrating. He understood I didn't know how to find myself, and instead of leaving me behind, he reached through the fog and pulled me into the moment with him. We've been celebrating each other ever since. I sent him pictures of jewelry I think Alexa would like. He calls me Ruby Rose and marches in pride with me. We go to gay bars and point out women we like, ask them where they got their shoes. Every Sunday following Thanksgiving, we go to the zoo and buy whatever the hell we want. At some point, I will get a drag king makeover and take an anniversary photo with Alexa. We'll hang it next to our temple wedding photos. When our daughter marries, I'll point to them and tell her, everything and everyone is meant to change. So practice shaping things and learn how to still cherish them when they're no longer what you thought they were. Love the changing more than the change. This is marriage.
If you can't love yourself, how in the hell you gonna love somebody else? Amen. Novocaine for the soul. You better give me something to fill the hole.
Sometimes in the depths of pain, we are tempted to ask, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? I testify the answer is yes. There is a physician. The atonement of Jesus Christ covers all these conditions and purposes of mortality.
That opening quote was Elder Kent Richards, a retired surgeon and a member of the Second Quorum of the 70, from his talk, The Atonement Covers All Pain, in the April 2011 General Conference. So, what's the worst pain you've ever experienced? Think about that for a moment. The first thing that comes to mind for me is all of the bowel obstructions that I've had from Crohn's disease. My intestine becomes inflamed to the point where it closes off. At its worst, the result is mind-blowing pain that makes me desperate for relief. I've had at least 50 episodes like that for the past 35 years, since I was 8 years old. As bad as the pain is from a bowel obstruction, the pain I've had from kidney stones has been even worse. What's amazing to me is that my kidney stones have been really small, like a grain of sand, or a mustard seed if you're into that kind of comparison. Unlike a bowel obstruction that can result in septic shock or death, a tiny, non-obstructive kidney stone like I had can be totally benign. It's amazing to me that this tiny irritation in a similarly tiny, almost transparently thin vessel can elicit such horrific pain. But I know it could always be worse. I'm fortunate to work as an anesthesiologist at a Level 1 trauma center and regional burn center. I see daily examples of how it could be worse, like end-stage lung disease, where you can never get enough air, which is often combined with the intense pain of chest tubes and a thoracotomy incision between the ribs, or motorcyclists who fly off their bikes or are dragged for long distances with long lists of fractures and internal injuries, or toddlers who fall into the bonfire. Burns not only injure and expose nerve endings, they increase metabolism, limiting the effect of pain medications. Pretty soon tolerance develops, and then pain management can become a real challenge. Now, everyone experiences some form of pain from the time they're born. When I consider my own chronic health problems, and then I consider the good fortune of my life, having been born of goodly parents, and just as an aside here, is goodly really an adjective? Because it sounds like an adverb. Anyway, having been born of goodly parents in a loving, stable home, in a nice, safe, and comfortable suburb, having my own loving family now with everything we need and most of whatever we want, and having amazing opportunities to travel, it makes me think I can't feel self-pity. I'm one of the most fortunate people in the world. Now, when I applied to medical school, I cited my experience as a patient as something that would help me sympathize with patients. And to some extent it has. But at least as often, it makes it more difficult for me to sympathize. Specifically, I've taken care of patients with the same problems as my own in the same hospitals where I've been a patient. And there have been times when those patients have told me that I don't know what it's like, or that I'm not doing enough. That's hard to take. Even when patients have different issues that I know should be less painful than what I've had, and then they weep and wail and threaten the people who are trying to care for them, it's hard not to belittle their experience. I can't say that I've completely overcome this bias, but an understanding of pain and an appreciation of individual experience have helped me to be less judgy. Pain can be broken down into two components, a sensory response and an emotional response. When I have a patient who's unconscious from anesthesia and the surgeon makes an incision and then the blood pressure and heart rate jump up, I can infer that the patient is responding to painful stimulation. To be clear, the patient is completely unaware. There's nothing unpleasant about it because the emotional response to this sensation is blocked by unconsciousness. Pain sensation from injury to tissue, like a surgical incision, is called nociception. When someone is conscious, the pain signals travel from the nerves to the spinal cord and up to the brain, where they connect to the parts that generate an emotional response. Without this emotional response, pain would be just another sensation. There's some variability in nociception from one person to another, but I see a lot more variability in the emotional component. Personally, I can relate to this by remembering what it was like to experience pain as a kid. Once, while I was trying to get the chain back on my bike, I skewered my thumb, trapping my bleeding hand between the chain and the tooth of the sprocket. I was terrified that I couldn't get my hand out, that I was bleeding, and that my mom wasn't there to fix it. So I cried, and I panicked, while my brother rode his bike home to get my mom. I was alone in an undeveloped part of the neighborhood with no one to hear me cry. I took a moment to feel my own pain. I could feel a throbbing numbness and a sense of pressure, but I was surprised that it didn't really hurt that much. So I stopped crying. The anxiety of being a child, alone, bleeding, and feeling trapped magnified my emotional response to the relatively minor nociception. Once I calmed myself down, resolving the emotional component, I had very little pain. Pain is the whole experience of sensation and emotional response. Chronic pain is different than acute pain, in large part because of the psychological toll that pain causes when you don't know if or when it might end. The emotional component of pain can spin out of control as the sensory component persists. So it's not surprising that people with chronic pain can develop mood disturbances. I remember one young man with a chronic painful condition with no cure who said, "I'm not depressed. My life just sucks." People with chronic pain develop changes in their personalities. One of the challenges in managing patients with chronic pain is that they can develop manipulative and deceptive behaviors to get attention and drugs. This happens to good people. One of the major challenges of pain medicine is that it takes a patient, firm, and compassionate person to recognize that manipulative behaviors and deception are a natural result of the emotional stress of chronic pain. So with that understanding of chronic pain, let's try a game of Would You Rather? Here we go. Would you rather have severe, daily, constant pain or unfathomable pain for a set time period, let's say 6 hours or less? What if the choice was between moderate chronic pain and excruciating pain for a matter of hours? How about mild pain? But once again, it never lets up, and there's no hope of it ever going away. Would that be better than the worst pain you could imagine for just a few hours? Would you rather suffer as Elizabeth Fritzl, imprisoned in a basement and raped by her father for 24 years with her mother as an accomplice, or suffer for a few hours until you bleed from every pore while your friends fall asleep nearby? Now, I don't want to minimize whatever suffering Jesus felt. If my son is freaking out about a skinned knee, telling him how calmly some boy dealt with pain from a femur fracture earlier that day will not ease my son's pain. In that regard, comparisons of pain sensation are not helpful because they fail to acknowledge the emotional component of pain. But the atonement is fundamentally a comparison of the Savior's pain and suffering with the individual and collective suffering of all humankind. As special witnesses of Jesus Christ, prophets and apostles have really emphasized just how much more Jesus suffered than you have. They don't buy into my notions that someone else's suffering doesn't make my suffering any less. Instead, we have one comparison after another between what we as mortals have suffered relative to Christ's atonement. Like Elder Holland's talk on mental illness in the October 2013 General Conference.
In striving for some peace and understanding in these difficult matters, it's crucial to remember that we are living and chose to live in a fallen world where, for divine purposes, our pursuit of godliness will be tested and tried again and again. Of greatest assurance in such a plan is that a Savior was promised, a Redeemer, who through our faith in Him would lift us triumphantly over those tests and trials, even though the cost to do so would be unfathomable for both the Father who sent Him and the Son who came. It is only an appreciation of this divine love that will make our own lesser suffering first bearable, then understandable, and finally redemptive.
Wow. Did you catch that last line? It is only an appreciation of this divine love that will make our own lesser suffering first bearable, then understandable, and finally redemptive. So, because Jesus suffered infinitely more than us, our suffering becomes bearable. You know, because the only thing better than the sum total of human suffering on this earth is that same amount of suffering plus an infinite degree of suffering by one individual. I picked this quote kind of randomly from a General Conference search for the term atonement. But it's interesting to contrast this with the more common claims that Christ's atonement pays the price to alleviate our physical suffering. And since the talk was on mental illness, I have to add here that there's no indication that Jesus ever felt hopeless or worthless or powerless, or like the world would be a better place without him, like people with major depressive disorder experience. One more thing. The hallmark feature of the suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane was the bleeding from every pore. As a kid, I thought this was really impressive. He suffered so much that he bled from every pore. As a physician, it seems completely unrelated. Like if I said that my patient was so anxious that his testicles exploded. As impressive as exploding testicles sound, it's hard to imagine a mechanism that links the event to anxiety. Likewise, bleeding from every pore conjures a dramatic visual, but it can't really establish a causal link between suffering and bleeding from every pore. If I had a patient who was bleeding from every pore, I wouldn't think that he or she was simply suffering too much. I've never seen anything remotely like it, and I can't come up with a plausible mechanism for a cause-effect relationship. It seems even more absurd to use the dramatic effect, bleeding from every pore, to indicate the strength of the unrelated cause, suffering. So let me assert my opinion, both personally and professionally, that no amount of pain and suffering in a finite time period, with the knowledge that it is to be short-lived and with the ongoing power to make it stop at any point, can compare to the kind of commonplace chronic human suffering that happens all around you, all over the world. Of course, I don't want to end with this dour emphasis on human suffering. You may draw inspiration from how Jesus maintained his composure through his suffering, how he never compromised his morals when challenged. Even though I don't believe in the divinity of Jesus, I can find value in that message. But I find greater beauty and inspiration in the world and the people around me. Ever since I stopped believing that everything good and wonderful and amazing was attributable to some supernatural being from somewhere near Kolob, I started realizing how incredible humanity can be. People who suffer continue to live their lives. They find ways to cope and to even find happiness. You can just do a quick Google search or go to your favorite news site to find inspiration from real people. I did that and found a Pakistani beauty salon that helps acid attack victims. I found a whole playlist of inspiring TED Talks. People who aren't suffering, who could simply sit back and enjoy their good fortune, instead find ways to help the human condition as well. Like Doctors Without Borders and Operation Smile. Those organizations provide unconditional care. You don't have to love or confess belief or comply with arbitrary rules and restrictions. In fact, you can be a total asshole and people will still try to help you. There are so many people who aren't well recognized, like social workers, public health officials, and yes, even politicians, who work to improve the lives of people who are resistant to being helped. And that's my thought to share, that the stories of real people around you are more incredible, more inspiring, and filled with greater compassion and greater capacity than the atonement of Jesus Christ. My life has been enhanced by recognizing that the real divinity that I see around me is inherently human, without supernatural influence. Recognizing the amazing power and willingness of people to make the world a better place motivates me to be a better person.
I, Jessica, born of goodly parents. Well, sort of goodly. They started out goodly, I suppose. Met at BYU, married in the temple, had 4 children, all girls, and lived the Mormon life. But things didn't work out so well for them. My father suffered from depression and severe migraines and found it very difficult to keep a job. My mother had done what she was supposed to do as a woman in the church, got her degree in early childhood development, and planned on being a stay-at-home mom. My dad's chronic unemployment made this plan very difficult, and his self-righteous, egocentric personality didn't help the matter. When I was very young, my parents got a divorce, and my 3 older sisters and I switched back and forth between living with both parents. Eventually, we settled in permanently with my mom at my grandmother's house. Not long after the divorce, my mother stopped going to church. While she told us it was because she couldn't get out of working her second job on Sundays, we all knew she just didn't like church anymore. The sisters and I continued our active church attendance with our grandmother in a very small ward in Salt Lake City. Living with all women was actually quite amazing. We never had to argue over watching a chick flick versus an action movie. We could have salad and pasta for dinner every night without complaint. We could talk about our periods and cramps right out in the open. Our vacations consisted of shopping and going to musicals and listening to Backstreet Boys CDs the entire time. It was awesome. The only problem was, in the eyes of the church, my home had something missing. The priesthood. While my father stayed active in the church and only lived about 20 minutes away, I didn't have the greatest relationship with him, and in my eyes, he was not a worthy priesthood holder. Growing up, I never asked for a father's blessing before the start of a school year or when I was sick, and it just felt awkward asking home teachers or someone else in the ward to do those things. To be honest, I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything that special. Don't get me wrong, I believed in the priesthood, and I believed it was important. But I couldn't understand why my personal prayers and my own pleas to the Lord sometimes needed to be trumped by a special blessing. When I was about 12, the news erupted with the story of Elizabeth Smart being taken from her home. She went to a neighboring middle school, close to mine, and I was terrified. I couldn't sleep in my room for weeks. I prayed and prayed for comfort from my anxieties, and I thought about getting a blessing because that is what Mormon people do. But it really bothered me that I would need to ask some random man from my ward to, in essence, come in and save the day in my priesthoodless home. If I was such a special daughter of God whom loved me dearly, my prayers should be sufficient to receive his blessings. In my day-to-day life, no one treated me or my family differently because of our unique living situation. But growing up Mormon, it was hard to miss the subtle and not-so-subtle messages that my family was not the ideal. In the primary song, Love is Spoken Here, a perfect Mormon family is described. It talks about a sweet mother giving a loving prayer and a strong priesthood-holding father leading the way, and together they bring love into the home. I would secretly laugh inside when singing that song, because it was so not my family. My mother wasn't active, my father was unemployed, and I only saw him a few times a month. While such a family sounded lovely, it kind of bothered me because I felt that my family was lovely too. Despite my mother's new lifestyle, including dating a heathen ex-Mormon who drank coffee, swore from time to time, and even spent the night sometimes, I adored my mom. She was selfless and kind and hilarious. And to be honest, I was kind of glad we didn't have a man living in our house interfering with the awesome girl vibe we had going on. I remember hearing in conference how important it was for children to have both a father and a mother in the home, implying that if you didn't have that, you might grow up deficient. I would always think about how toxic it would have been if my parents had stayed together. My dad had some great qualities, but he was pretty selfish, and I could barely handle living with him for a week when we would go on vacations. In fact, I had a pretty sour taste of the influences of men in my life, as most of them were not the greatest role models. Yet I had an abundance of amazing women all around me. These kinds of conference talks really bothered me because not only did I feel I was doing just fine being raised by all women, but I was probably better off. I would hear all my friends with normal Mormon families talk about how they really just wanted to be stay-at-home moms someday, so they weren't very worried about what they would study in college. I would always remind them that you might not want to bank on that plan because I had learned from my mother, you never know what situation you might be in someday. This influence taught me and my sisters to plan on having to take care of yourself, and if you find someone to share that burden with, great, but you don't want to rely on that. Despite my so-called broken family, all of my sisters and I were on the honor roll in high school, pretty much completely missed the whole rebellious teenager stage, and now all of us have master's degrees and are on satisfying career paths. Despite our feminist ways, we even all found husbands and were married in the temple. Now that my grandmother has passed away and my mother finally married to her apostate boyfriend, my childhood home, full of fond memories, is occupied by strangers. Sometimes I walk in the park across the street from that home and think back to those days. It makes me sad to think that people in my ward back then probably felt bad for me and were concerned about me not having a priesthood holder to bless our family. But the lessons I learned at that home are priceless to me. I learned to value hard work, education, self-reliance, and to not judge other people. And now that I see the teachings of the church in a completely different way, I am so glad I was forced to be different in the church back then, because it helped me realize early on that there is more than one way to have a happy home. So even though I was not born to so-called goodly parents as described by the church, I think I turned out more well-rounded and open-minded person than I would have if I had been born into that perfect Mormon family.
Hi, my name is Jamie Handy, and I'm a longtime listener of Infants on Thrones, and I'm also an avid listener of Mormon-themed podcasts. I have probably listened to them all, or pretty close to them all. I do spend a lot of time carpooling these days. And there's one topic that I just feel like nobody really hits on, and for me, it's a big one. And that is the disconnect between our theology about eternal progression and eternal families. And it manifests itself in so many different ways. So first, we teach that families can be together forever. And in the Brigham Young manual for Priesthood and Relief Society several years ago, there was a quote that got quoted all the time that he said, "If a man and woman are faithful to their new and everlasting covenant of marriage, then their children are theirs forever, even if their children end up in some other kingdom. They're there forever." And that was a big comfort to a lot of people because they know that as long as they stay true to their marriage covenants, their children will be theirs forever and ever. To me, the problem is that we believe we are also spiritual peers, that our children are actually our siblings. So that if, let's say, our children get married and are faithful to their covenants, then they will end up as our spiritual peers. So the celestial kingdom will be filled with nothing but couples. Well, unless you consider all those polygamous unions. But it will be husband and wife teams, and each little husband-wife team will be a peer to the other husband-wife team as children of our Heavenly Father. And it will be this couples place where then you will go on and create spiritual offspring that are different from the children you had in this world. So if you raise up your children good on the earth and they get married in the temple, they will be a peer couple in heaven, but they won't be your child. They'll be your peer. They'll be your sibling. But if your children mess up here and end up in a lower kingdom, then those children are yours forever, according to Brigham Young. And this just doesn't make any sense to me, because when people talk about eternal families, they cling to this mother, father, young children scenario. And I feel like it has a lot of social ramifications, like that Mormon moms want to hang on to those apron strings a little tighter, because really, they will always be your mom, and they have to kind of control your life as you go all along. Once you reach adulthood on the earth, I think that in many other homes and families, children naturally move to a position of being a peer with their parent. Part of it, I think, is rites of passage in the regular world that we don't have in the Mormon world. And I think a big one of those is drinking. That at some point, because your child is 21 and is able to drink you perceive them as an adult. They can now go do adult things with you. They can sit at the adult bar with you. And when they have that major coming of age adulthood moment where the two of you can sit down and share a glass of wine or have a beer together, it puts you on equal footing. And so outside of the church, children, as they grow up, progress more to a peer relationship with their parents as they get older. But in the Mormon world, once you're their child, you are always seen as the child. You are always lower. You are always lesser. You are always supposed to answer to them. You're supposed to honor your parents. They have this eternal position above you. And I don't think that's necessarily true. In fact, my favorite is where they talk about how the most noble, every new generation of kids is the more righteous generation saved for the last day. So that would mean, in terms of spirituality, each generation being born progressively closer to the second coming is higher up on the spiritual plateau. So in many ways, parents will be subordinate to their children as far as righteousness goes, because I was clearly saved for a later day than my parents because of my righteousness. So in the celestial kingdom, when we're all peers, me and my husband might actually be higher than you and your husband, even though you were my parents on earth, because I was one of the closer generations to the second coming. And my children, likewise, are, you know, once again, they're told they're extra special, super chosen, that if the whole world in human existence is a clock, they're born at 11:59. I was 11:59 and 10 seconds. So they're 11:59 and 12 seconds before the second coming. And so it sets up this funny thing where if you... We talk about eternal families, but that doesn't really exist in our concept of the afterlife. There is only eternal couples. Another really big ramification, I think, is just with the roles of women in the church. Because since the proclamation of the family, women's roles as being a mom forever, the eternal mom, it is hammered into you. This is your eternal identity. This is your eternal job. And I just don't see it. I don't see it evident in anything that we do. For example, when you go to the temple and you watch the creation story, it's not our mom whose whole job is to be our creator of our spirits and nurture and love us that's doing the creation. It's a bunch of men. And when our mom's main job on earth, according to the family proclamation, is to nurture and love and strengthen their kids, it's certainly not our mother, heavenly mother's eternal job, because she is completely incognito. So you wonder, there's this big difference between what women are told is their eternal role and then what we are told our eternal mother actually does. She does nothing that we can see. She doesn't comfort, nurture. She doesn't love. She's not there to support us. She didn't even create us. And yet that's supposedly our heritage, this eternal mom role that we're going to have. And so I think it, women are confused. They're unhappy. They feel unfulfilled because this mom job, if you do it well, you just disappear. You don't get to be a mom to these kids forever. And you disappear to whoever your spiritual children are. They'll never know you. They don't know who you are. And it just leaves me confused. It seems to me that we have all these different doctrines, and when you extend them out and look at them beyond just this very brief moment, that they all are at odds with each other. And they all leave me feeling this really yucky bad taste.
Every Mormon who's gone on a mission has some stories about it. I'm no exception. Some are life-changing, some are banal, and some are just weird. My stories today are probably more of that last one. I serve my mission in La Paz, Bolivia. It's a city set high up in the Andes Mountains of South America, and at least when I was there, Bolivia was the poorest country on the continent. Needless to say, technological innovation was not something that I expected to see much of. So I had a hard time coming up with an explanation when, on our way home from a long day of walking up and down the mountainside that was our area, my companion and I saw a UFO. At least, it seemed to be up in the sky, and we couldn't identify it, so that's what we went with. It started out as something relatively ordinary. We saw an orange light appear over at the edge of the horizon and slowly make its way across the sky. As it came into better view, we could see that it was quite a bit brighter and appeared larger than any airplanes we had seen. And to confirm that we were looking at something different, when it reached the center of the sky, the light stopped moving completely. By that time, my companion and I had stopped walking as well, and we were just watching to see what would happen. The orange light hung motionless in the air for about 3 or 4 minutes, and then started rising straight up. Over the next few minutes, it continued upward, getting dimmer and dimmer, until it vanished from sight. The whole time, my companion and I were trying out theories for what it could be. As I mentioned, we ruled out airplane fairly quickly, and then suggested other things. A helicopter? Yeah, a helicopter can hover and ascend, but helicopters are small, and that light was brighter than the lights on an incoming jetliner. And besides, how high do helicopters fly? This thing went so high we couldn't see it anymore. It certainly went higher than a hot air balloon could go. Unless it was one of those weather balloons. But who would put a gigantic light on a weather balloon? Are there any military bases near? I don't know, probably. But what would Bolivia be doing with unidentifiable military aircraft? Do you really think it could be an alien spaceship? Nah. But maybe. In the end, we just walked home and went to bed, wondering if we had seen something extraordinary. My other story also involves a walk in the dark, in a different area of La Paz, with a different companion. We were nearing the end of the day, but we had just enough time to go knock a few more doors before we had to head back in order to be home before our curfew. So we headed down a dirt road toward a place that we hadn't visited before. It was pitch dark, and there were no street lights, but we were pretty much used to that. As we walked down the road, I suddenly got a really dark feeling. It wasn't like anything I had experienced before, and I had the very strong impression that if we continued down that road, something very bad would happen to us. I stopped walking, so my companion did too. I told him that I had a spiritual premonition and that we shouldn't go any further, and he said he felt the same. So we turned around and just went home a little early. At the time, this was a very strong testimony builder to me that the power of Satan was real, but that the Spirit could protect us if we were worthy. So what do these stories have in common? In a word, uncertainty. To this day, I still don't know what that light in the Bolivian sky was, if it was something mundane or something extraterrestrial. Although, just to put my cards on the table, I find the alien explanation to be highly unlikely. Likewise, I still don't know what would have happened to my companion and me if we had continued down that dark road. But the way I process things like that has changed since losing my belief in the truthfulness of Mormonism. I never claimed to know that I would have come to harm if I hadn't listened to the Spirit on that night, but as a believer, I was pretty convinced that I had dodged a bullet, figuratively, and perhaps even literally. The notion that I had a bad feeling about something fit perfectly into the narrative that the Spirit would protect me by sending me promptings, so that's what I believed. Now, on the other hand, I figure that there was no need for any external source for my feelings. It was a dark night, I was in an unfamiliar place, and to be honest, I didn't really want to be going there anyway. And I never even talked about the incident with my companion later. I don't know if he also had a strong feeling before I said something to him, or if he was just going along with me because he didn't want to be there either. None of that mattered at the time, because the explanation I had fit my expectations, so that's all I needed. The UFO incident was a bit harder to quantify for me. Mormons do believe in life outside Earth, I suppose, but there's no theological certainty about whether God's other children have visited our planet, or if they take the same form as us, or even if they live in the same universe as we do. Suffice it to say, alien spaceships aren't a core part of Mormonism, despite the science fiction-y feel of some of its doctrines. Stories about strange lights in the skies being evidence of extraterrestrial visitors are a part of my wider culture, but they weren't really a part of my belief system, so I didn't immediately latch on to that as an explanation for my experience. I never really did think it was actually a flying saucer-type UFO, even though I didn't have a good explanation for what it was. I was okay with the idea that there probably was a natural explanation, even if I never found out what that explanation was in the end. Psychologists have a term for people's desire to have a firm answer about things. They call it the need for cognitive closure. People who have a high need for cognitive closure tend to come to conclusions quickly about things and stick to those conclusions more firmly than people with a low need for closure. Those with a high need for closure tend to be uncomfortable with ambiguity and are highly motivated to come to a decision one way or another about situations they're faced with. High need for closure is correlated with increased racial and gender prejudice, a preference for authoritarianism, and higher levels of religiosity, especially religious fundamentalism. It's not hard to see how Mormonism could fit into that schema. It is an intricate set of beliefs that professes to have answers to all of the most important questions about life and the afterlife, and also provides more rules for the humdrum day-to-day aspects of living than just about any other system out there. If you've got a question, Mormonism probably has an answer. That answer may be totally out there and completely unsupported by actual reality, but it has an answer. If you are a person who hates not knowing exactly what you should do in any given situation, having a prophet who can give counsel from God about everything from exactly how much money to give to your church to how many earrings your teenage daughter should wear, that must be really appealing. Combine that with the strong emphasis that you can get individualized answers from the Spirit and the constant affirmation from your fellow church members that they know everything the church says is completely true, and you've got a paradise for someone who hates ambiguity. For certain ways of practicing Mormonism, there's no ambiguity left anywhere. Your whole life is planned out for you, and your afterlife too, as long as you stick to the program. I'd be lying if I said that wasn't a little bit enticing to me. As a believer, I got a lot of satisfaction out of knowing exactly what was expected of me and what I could expect in return. So why did I leave the church? Maybe that has something to do with the different reactions I had to the two mission stories I described earlier. I really did believe in the influence of the Spirit at the time, so when I experienced something that fit that narrative, I accepted it quickly and didn't look back. But the strange light in the sky didn't fit neatly into any of my prior beliefs, and I didn't have an urgent need to make it fit. I haven't taken any of the psychological tests or anything, but I don't think I have a very high need for cognitive closure. And even though I was in a religion that absolutely caters to that personality type, I didn't have a need for that as a missionary either. A decade or so later, when I came across information that contradicted my closely held beliefs, it was difficult, but my beliefs changed. I didn't hold on to those beliefs at all costs. Could that happen again? Could I have my world turned upside down again at some point later in life? Maybe. There are a lot of things out there to learn, and I'm sure some of them are pretty important. For the moment, there are a lot of areas where I simply have to say, I don't know. And that's just fine with me.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle, oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they be singing so happily, oh, joyfully.
You know, I just want to say a few things here to wrap up this episode. You listeners are awesome. Seriously, you're amazing. For as burnt out as I can get hearing these kinds of faith crisis stories, for as long as I've been doing this, I really find it inspiring to think about how many of us share these similar experiences and how this silly, goofy, throwaway podcast that's just a hobby for us, like Infants on Thrones, can actually become a vehicle where many people can express themselves. And when we get our listeners involved, like with this latest batch of essays, we can sometimes do it in really creative, articulate, and poignant ways. Now, like I said earlier, some of these essays have sat for over a year, and I'm really sorry about that. I will personally try to do a better job of being more responsive when these things come in, and I want to encourage those of you who are listening to this right now, who feel so moved by the spirit of these messages. It's starting to sound a little like a testimony meeting, isn't it? But I want to encourage you to rise and come up to the podium and share your thoughts, share your stories. Try to understand yourselves better through essays like this, and try to understand the experiences of others around you. Now, I hope that we keep publishing listener essays, even if it's bundled up in episodes like this. So please forgive us of our shortcomings and not getting to these sooner, and please keep them coming. Because none of us are professionals here. None of us are experts on anything other than our own lived experience. We're all just doing the best that we can despite our many mistakes and our many imperfections. We are flawed. We're still learning. We are all infants on thrones. Nice, huh? So anyway, yeah, keep the essays coming, and more listener outros, too. Those are great. I love when those come in. So thanks, everyone, and happy Independence Day, you infants, you.
Hillary.
Matthew, Ryan,
Carol,
Keith,
Ashley,
and I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.